This is the third story that we have in Lent of Jesus's healing, of Jesus going beyond the bounds of Judaism and seeing, finding, touching, healing people who become disciples, the least likely, certainly not the ones that the Pharisees and the disciples expect to be chosen. We have the story of the Canaanite woman who came, barged into a room full of men and demanded that Jesus hear her, see her, and heal her daughter who had demons, who was sick with demons. And he wasn't very nice to her, and she stayed in conversation with him and convinced him to see her, to get her, to see her daughter and heal her daughter. We had the story of the Samaritan woman whom Jesus met at the well. She was alone, cast out, whom he saw, not with the label that had been attached to her, not with the sinfulness that had been assumed of her for many generations, but with her God-given self and the injustice that she had lived through, being discarded or widowed and going through husband after husband because that was the only way a woman had any worth and any safety. And yet she stayed in conversation with him as he offered her the living water. And today we have the man born blind. Jesus is on the way, on the journey, which is our faith. It's not a destination. It's a lifelong journey. And he sees this beggar sitting in the dirt. He sees the man born blind, not the beggar. He sees more deeply. We have in this story the struggle, conflict between the Jews who followed Jesus, the Messianic Jews, and those that didn't, the Jews, the Pharisees, who were sharply divided among themselves. And we hear a little bit of that today in the rhetoric in the church and in certainly in the secular world, where the sides are dividing and turning on each other and they can't agree, and particularly the sides that are into certainty and naming and blaming and shaming and excluding. Throughout the gospel, Jesus rebukes the Jews for their failure to recognize or understand him. And a lot of people either love John's gospels because it denigrates the Jews, or they don't like John's gospel because it's been taken as anti-Semitic. But a better translation of the Jews is the Judeans. And it's sort of like sometimes people outside our country talk about Americans, or you've heard people talk about Mexicans. And we know that that doesn't mean all people. It means certain people to some people. And so the Jews that are talked about in John's Gospels are the ones that are intractable, that hold on to their faith tradition so tightly, every dot and tittle of the 800 or 600 and so laws, they want to claim those, and they're very into the right way and the wrong way. John's focus on people outside the inner circle, between the chosen ones and the chosen one, and those who do get him and become disciples in their own right, but yet they didn't know themselves as the chosen ones. The story has a metaphor of seeing, and it's about seeing with the heart. In Chiapas, where I lived, the people there, the indigenous people, didn't say, "How are you?" They said, "How is your heart?" And they really looked for people's hearts. And they told me one day that most of us have the bad habit of covering our hearts up and wearing a mask, right? That facade. And I was teaching them Reiki, and it was a long course. And I finally asked this group who had come in from their rural communities, group of men, indigenous men, why they had trusted me. And they said, "Hermana, it's because we can see your heart." And you know that sense where you meet someone and you see their heart immediately, or sometimes you meet someone and you don't like them, you don't see their heart immediately, and it takes years for them to reveal their heart. when you can finally get under that facade and love them for who they are, that you were wrong about them, but they had covered their heart up so much that you couldn't really see the real them there. That seeing with the heart is a lifelong journey, and letting our heart being seen. The man born blind's faith journey is a growing empowerment that comes with seeing at a deeper level, seeing his own God-given potential, which Jesus holds up to him like a mirror, as Jesus so often does. We have the contrast in this story between the man's openness and his unabashed faith, his willingness to get up and go to the pool because Jesus said to do that, his agency to help heal himself, and the fear-filled, closed-hearted, and minded Pharisees. John's gospel is all about the theology of relationship. And there are many churches, there is a theology that focuses on belief. But I believe that John's gospel is much more about relationship. God's forward movement of the good news happens in relationship with people. I know Jim has a relationship with our sexton, which is a really important relationship. And God's good news moves forward in that because those two can talk to each other and understand where it may not be available to our sexton Gran in another environment. So it's that reaching out and seeing and making a space for that conversation, that seeing another as someone who's worthy as a theological discourse and certainly worthy of discipleship. We also have a focus on sin in this story. The disciples want to know, whose sin was it? Was it his parents or was it his sin? I know so many parents who carry this weight of blame that they had a stillbirth child, that they had a child born with Down syndrome, that they had a child born with a disability, a mental, emotional, or physical disability, that it was somehow their fault. We had testimonies in the earlier service of people who said that one woman has rheumatoid arthritis and her coworker keeps telling her if she would just go to her church and come to Jesus and believe and pray that she would be healed. And the woman, it hurt her to hear this over and over. And the woman finally stood up and said, "You need to stop. This is hurtful." And she said, "I have a church where I'm welcome and I believe I'm healing, but it's not in some formula. And it's not about what I believe. It's about what I do with our life, my life." Her coworker continued to push, continued to insist that she was somehow sinful and that she could be washed clean. That kind of stuff happens all the time. It happens to me on the airplane when somebody asks me what I do and I say I'm a pastor and they get it that I'm not the kind of pastor that they know should be a pastor. And how many parents feel that they've done something wrong when their child is an addict or criminal or is gay or lesbian or transgender or bisexual or gender fluid or different from what society says is normal? My mom, I think, went to her grave thinking that she had done something that had made me a lesbian. Or if she hadn't done something or hadn't let me do something, I would not be a lesbian. Even though she came to love me and accept me and celebrate who I was, there was this deeply seated sense of shame and blame and sinfulness that she carried to her grave. She couldn't celebrate when I was ordained and my sister who came with her couldn't celebrate either because she was embarrassed for my mother, who was embarrassed for me. That sense of who's at fault. You know, it reminds me when we point at somebody and say, it's your fault, you're the sinner, and beware of places and people that you go and say, that person's a sinner. Because when we blame somebody and point them out, we've got four fingers pointing right back at us, right? We don't take into account our part in that. Not only that part in the fault, but even more so the part in our remembering to celebrate the person as they are and not insisting that they change, but being willing to walk with them if they do change. Jesus replied, it was neither the man's fault nor his parents. It was to let God's works shine forth in this person. Not that God made that person blind or make someone disabled or make someone be assaulted so that God's works can shine through that person, but that God's works can shine through that person exactly as they are, exactly the way they're born. That light is in them, if they can't get up off the ground, if they're in a wheelchair for life, if they've done something terribly wrong and are on death row, God's works can still shine through that person, and those people can become leaders in the faith. And believe me, they do. A woman was telling me earlier that a good friend of hers who's 59 is dying of bladder cancer. And he was in a gang in somewhere in Arizona, and he moved to Phoenix, and he turned his life around, and he was really doing well, and he went to school, he became a social worker, and he went back, I think it was Yuma, he went back, and his gang found out that he was in town, and they stabbed him. And at 19, he became paraplegic, lower body. But in a wheelchair, he was joy incarnate, and he would get out on the dance floor, and girls and men would dance with him, and he would put them in his lap and dance slow dances, and people would laugh with him and loved him. He never had the relationship he wanted to have. He never married, and he never had children, and he's dying. But he has seeded joy and hope, inspired so many people that at 59, his life has been worthy. He has been a disciple for Christ, whether he calls it that or not. I find it fascinating that Jesus got down on the ground. Jesus got down on the level with the man in the dirt, where the man begged. You've seen beggars on the street. Have you ever gotten down on the cement with them, on the urine-soaked cement, on the place where they sleep and eat and do other bodily functions? Jesus got down on the ground with him. He was on his way to do something, and he saw him, but he didn't heal him. He took some of the dirt, and he spat in it, and he made mud, and he put it on the man's eyes. He didn't heal him. He took his body and shared it with the man. The readers, the listeners would remember, from ashes we come, to ashes we go. From dust we come, to dust we go. They remember the vision of the potter making humanity out of clay. Jesus is recreating. This is my body poured out for you with spit and mud. He tells the man to go to Siloam, the pool of Siloam, and I called my trusty friend Joe Seeger, our resident archaeologist, who has way more knowledge about these things than I do. I said, Joe, tell me about the Pool of Siloam. And Joe said that the Pool of Siloam, 700 years before the birth of Jesus, was a pool that had been dug into rock outside of the city of David, ancient city of Jerusalem. And it was a place that the pilgrims on their way to Jerusalem would stop and water their animals, wash their face, get a good drink, maybe wash off before they went into the holy city. In the memory of the people, it was a place where a people were God's people, where they were on a journey together, and they would go into Jerusalem together after washing and watering their animals at the Pool of Siloam. We think later there's a theory that some kind of waterways, not aqueducts, but waterways would then irrigate the land around that. And actually that one was dug through 3/4 of a mile of rock so that water from that pool outside the city gates could be delivered to the city when Jerusalem was under siege and the temple was under siege. In the story, when Jesus tells the man to go wash in the pool of Siloam, this isn't a mikveh bath. This isn't a place where Jews went for ritual healing. He was telling the man to go past the synagogue, to go outside the city walls, beyond the walls, beyond what he knew, to bathe in the pool of Siloam. In this man's deepest memory, he would know that this was a place where his ancestors went together, when they were a people, before the second temple was destroyed. John's listeners, John's community, wouldn't remember the pool of Siloam, but they would know the story, because after the destruction of the temple, Joe tells me, then the rains brought all of the sludge down and it filled the pool, and it became a city dump. And so the people in John's gospel would only remember this precious pool, this gathering place, like the woman at the well, the living water, as a dump. So for him to send the man to the pool was to reconnect the people with their history, with the potential of their community. It was to help people remember the journey, the cleansing, and it was to say, go outside the systems and structures, go outside of what we think is normal, go outside of the rules that we've so carefully made and laid, and see the person, not the disease process or the condition. I think that what Jesus did is what an ally does. The White Privilege Let's Talk group has been talking about what it means to be an ally. And it's very complicated about, you know, the different levels of oppression and not speaking for people when they can speak for themselves. Jesus gets down on the man's level. He sees him. He touches him. Someone who's seen as impure, who's invisible, a sightless man, a beggar. And he says, go. And the man is willing to participate in his own healing. Because you know what? There's a lot of people who go to church because they want to be healed. There's a lot of people who go to faith healers or doctors or fortune tellers, and they want the clue. They want to know what's wrong with them, and they want it lifted. They want to be baptized and come out of that water and be made whole. But it's a process, and it takes relationship. It takes people handing off to people, handing off to people, handing off to people, until we all get there together. Jesus was an ally. I was thinking about how I was going to finish my sermon yesterday as I spent most of my day in the emergency room with a friend of the church who for the 14th day had a migraine headache, level 10 on the pain scale. And when I texted her to see how she was doing, I got one word back: terrible. I called her and spoke with her, and she agreed to go in an ambulance to the hospital where I met her about 45 minutes later. She was in the room with a light on, with no cover on her, and had no attention since the EMTs dropped her off. She was seizing because of the pain, and I went out to the nurse's station, and I said, excuse me, there's a person in there. She's really suffering. It's my sister. That's what I say because they think we're gay, and sometimes I don't have good service, so I say, that's my sister, and they're like, whatever. But they listen to me, and they said, well, the doctor isn't around. Well, when will the doctor come? We don't know. We don't know where he is. So I go back in. I sit with her for about 10 minutes. I call our faith community nurse, Maureen Nadeau, who's sick, in the bed, and I said, what do I do? And she said, get your badass on and go out there and say, we have a neurological crisis happening. I want the doctor now, which I did. And in 3 minutes, he was there. And she had warming blankets, and he was kind. prejudice and labeling and business as usual is systemic. And good people, the nurses were good people, I'm convinced. But one told me that she saw a lot of migraines, not people with migraines, but migraines. And I had to insist the whole time I was there that this person be seen as a person. And when she finally got her concoction 3 hours later, they said, "Well, we think you can go home now." And I said, "How is your pain?" And she said, it's an eight. And so I said, "More?" So she got more, and then she got more. And then when it was a level five, she was sent home. And you know our healthcare system is broken, and you know that there's really good people trying to do really good work. And there's no hospital that's bad or emergency room that's bad. But there were two people there, a nursing school teacher, and a student. And they saw her, and they treated her like a person, and they asked her how she was doing, and they touched her, and they came back to check on her. They were Jesus that day. And so I say that our role as church, being the church, is to be allies, to be there in the hospital. And the nurse came up to me, the nurse that gave me a hard time, and said, "Wow, you really have amazing community." Because I was there, there were people on the phone, they knew our community faith nurse was on the phone with me. Another friend from our faith community on Saturday night came and stayed with her. Another person was in the wings. And I said, "Yeah, that's what church is. That's what we do." And the nurse is like, "Wow." So there's the dominant narrative of seeing the label, seeing the disease, seeing the condition, and going with it, not wanting to go against the flow, not wanting to be the parents, not wanting to speak up for that person, saying, "Let that person fend for themselves. You're on your own, buddy." Or having this alternative narrative that says, "I see you. I get you. I hear you. I'm here with you," even if it's to sit with suffering. And it's to allow ourselves to be vulnerable enough to let others be our Jesus. To let others be our Jesus. And when we see the Pharisees, or we find that in ourselves, to notice and to remember that we're all on our way. This is a journey, not a destination, a lifelong journey to be the church. Amen.